All right, folks, welcome back to another edition of The Realist Report. This is your host, John Friend. Today is Saturday, February 27th, 2021. Of course, my website is therealistreport.com, where you will find an extensive archive of these podcasts, as well as other programs I've participated in. You will also find all of my blog posts and articles, a contact page, my Twitter feed, which is embedded in the right-hand sidebar of the website, and many other useful and important links. I am a regular reporter for American Free Press, America's last real newspaper, and I also contribute to the Barnes Review, the bi-monthly revisionist history magazine. Please do subscribe to these fine print publications if you do not already. Check out AmericanFreePress.net and BarnesReview.com for all the details. All right, with that said, let's introduce our special guests this afternoon, Fred Leuchter and Jim Rizzoli, two of the finest and most knowledgeable revisionists in America, are joining me for this special episode. Fred, welcome to the program, sir. How are you?
Very good, and yourself?
I'm doing just fine. Thank you very much for joining us. And Jim, thank you as well. How are you doing today, sir?
I'm still here, still alive.
Good, yes. Very crazy world we're living in. It always has been crazy, but with this fake pandemic and this whole political situation, it's really getting interesting, to say the least. And yeah. I've been a big fan of both you guys' work for a number of years. You guys have both been guests on this program in the past. And I actually was just watching a recent BitChute video interview that you guys did. Jim, I think your brother was involved as well, and that was very interesting. Yeah. I subscribe to your BitChute channel and kind of stay up to speed with the information you're putting out, and you got a great channel, so I tip my hat to you, and I'm sure you'll put this interview up there as well.
Yeah.
So I don't really want to get into any introductions. You guys, you know, as I mentioned, you guys have both been on the program before, and people are familiar with both of your work over the years. And this is kind of a special episode I wanted to do, kind of just dedicated to the fake Holocaust narrative, a topic you guys are experts on, in my opinion anyways. And there have been a couple of recent news items I wanted to bring up and kind of highlight. To get started, I'm sure you guys saw there was a headline, just a week ago, a 95-year-old German man who was living in the United States for decades, I think going back to the late 1950s, if I'm not mistaken. He was recently deported from the state of Tennessee back to Germany, and it made some headlines around the country and even internationally for that matter. I'm looking at an article here from the Times of Israel that was published about a week ago, so last weekend. Headline here is, U.S. deports 95-year-old ex-Nazi concentration camp guard to Germany. Friedrich Karl Berger, who was living in Tennessee, served as an armed guard at Neuengamme concentration camp in 1945. I'm not sure if I pronounced that German word correctly. Germany is saying that they are unlikely to try him, citing insufficient evidence, but U.S. authorities decided it was still necessary to deport this 95-year-old man. Let me just briefly read the article, and then I'll get you guys' take on it. It's a pretty short piece here. It says here, a 95-year-old former Nazi concentration camp guard who has been living in the United States was deported Saturday to Germany, the Justice Department said. Friedrich Karl Berger, who had been living in Tennessee and had German citizenship, was deported for taking part in Nazi-sponsored acts of persecution while serving as an armed guard at the Neuengamme concentration camp in 1945, the department said. Quote, Berger's removal demonstrates the Department of Justice's and its law enforcement partners' commitment to ensuring that the United States is not a safe haven for those who have participated in Nazi crimes against humanity and other human rights abuses, said Acting Attorney General Monty Wilkinson. A U.S. immigration judge ordered the deportation of Berger, who has been living in the U.S. since 1959, in March of last year. And it goes on to describe his work. He was stationed near Meppen, and he was apparently working as an armed guard at one of these camps. And of course, you know, they tie in the fake narrative of how these people were being persecuted and murdered and forced to march in these, what do they call them, Beth marches. Of course, there's very little evidence to demonstrate any of this, which German authorities readily admit and have even said that they're likely not even going to prosecute him. So it just seems like a pretty malicious thing for U.S. authorities to do, to deport this 95-year-old man who, again, had been living in the United States since the late 1950s. And that quote from the acting attorney general, Monty Wilkinson, kind of summarizes everything. Like, these people are so focused on hunting down these elderly German citizens, you know, at the behest of Jews and to advance this tyrannical Jewish narrative of the fake Holocaust story. You know, we can dedicate all this money and effort and resources to hunting down 95-year-old German men, yet we can't even arrest these BLM criminals who have ransacked and looted and pillaged the entire country the past year. Fred, why don't we turn this over to you? This is pretty typical. These stories come out, you know, it seems like once every few months, where some, you know, elderly German citizen that's been living in the U.S. for decades is, you know, uprooted and sent back to Germany to face charges for, you know, quote unquote, participating in the Holocaust. What's your take on this, Fred?
Well, sounds to me like shades of John Demjanjuk, and you may remember him a number of years ago. These people that they're deporting, these people that they're extraditing, these were all people that were very low on the totem pole, if they worked at the camps at all. But the bottom line is they were certainly very low. They were guards. And deporting somebody who was a private in the military. He didn't know what was going on anyway. They never bothered to tell him. So, I mean, it's ludicrous. And by the time these people get to be 80 or get to be 90 years old or older, they don't know what's happening anyway. So, I don't know. I assume he had a family here. They tore him away from his family because he certainly had 30 years or more to build one. It's just a terrible thing. These people that do these things should be ashamed of themselves. But our Justice Department, and particularly the section that deals with crimes against humanity and such, most of these people are Jews, and all they have in their mind is they want to kill Germans. So I don't know what the answer is, but certainly they shouldn't have deported them.
Right. Yeah, they clearly want vengeance, it seems like. Well, and it says in this article and in other articles I read about it, when he was interviewed about his role at this, you know, alleged concentration camp or death camp or however they frame it, he basically just admitted that, yeah, he was a guard. His role was to prevent people from escaping the camp. I mean, that's pretty standard. That's like what any, you know, armed guard would be responsible for. But he also said that he was not aware of anybody being mistreated. He was not aware of anybody being murdered or, you know, systematically persecuted or tortured or anything like that. So, I mean, again, it sort of undercuts this idea that this was like, you know, a death camp or these people were even being, you know, severely mistreated, which I think is a total lie in many cases. Jim, what's your take on this? Did you see this story?
Oh, yeah. This is just your typical vindictiveness, power trip of the Jews to show their power and how they can continue to use this topic as a boot on our neck. And it just shows you how small the topic is, too, because, see, when he came into the country, okay, originally back in whenever it was, 1959, was it? I believe he had to sign a form, and the form probably said something like this: were you ever part of any criminal activity in Germany or wherever the hell it was? You know, dealing, I don't know if it says the Holocaust or whatever, you know, dealing with people, genocide or whatever. And he had to say, obviously, no. So it's kind of like a real technical point, because if he said yes, he wouldn't have been able to come into the country. All right. So he had to say no, because, you know, he didn't feel he was part of it anyway. So they're getting him on a technical point. All right. Just typical. But again, to show you the power and the vindictiveness of the Jews, because see, they have to keep this story going year after year, and they're going to keep doing this. Don't think he's not the last one. They'll probably have his dog next. You know, his dog Fifi, you know, was his dog, and his dog is part of this too, or whatever. But they're going to just keep the thing going forever. And I think last week or a couple weeks ago, there was a woman, an older woman, a secretary that worked in one of the camps, and they're trying to do the same thing with her. Okay. But now let's just take this, go backwards here. Why don't they do this with the Russians coming in? Okay, we get all these Russians coming in from Russia or Europe or wherever the hell they're from. Okay, I'm sure they signed on that form. Oh, no, I wasn't any part of any of this. And yet, you know, they were probably part of going into Berlin, raping all the women, killing all the Germans or whatever they were doing. And yet no one takes these people up on their lying on this form either. So obviously it's just one big, you know, hypocritical thing that's going on here. The Germans have one set of rules. Everybody else coming into the country, the guards, let's say the Sonderkommando that were in the camps, you know, the Jewish Sonderkommandos that were actually in charge of the camps. The German soldiers weren't in charge of the camps. The Sonderkommando was. And they did a lot of bad things to their own Jewish people. But do you see them being deported? Does anybody say about, hey, you know, you killed, Ira over here when you were in this camp? No, nobody does that, okay? It's only the Germans.
Yeah, exactly. Well, and, you know, this, as I mentioned, this sort of happens every couple. I'm getting an echo. Can anybody else hear
that? I hear it, too.
Yep. Let's see if it'll go away. I can still hear it. But my point is that this seems to happen once every couple months. You know, you'll hear a story about this, about some elderly German individual being deported or being persecuted in Germany. Does anybody know where that echo is coming from? Because that's
I don't hear an echo.
I hear it, but I don't know where it's coming from.
Okay. I can definitely hear it. I'm not sure if it's going to be picked up in the recording, but let's just see if we can carry on here. But yeah, it seems to be something that happens once every every couple months or whatever. You'll hear it. You'll see a headline about it, and it is really just incredible. It shows how vengeful and just ruthless the Jews are. In fact, just a couple days before this headline came out, Ephraim Zuroff, who's like this professional like gangster Jewish Nazi hunter. He worked for the Simon Wiesenthal Center, I believe. And, you know, like basically his entire career has been dedicated to, you know, like persecuting and rounding up Nazis all over the world, in South America, all over Europe, in America, Canada, Australia, and you know, bringing them up on these, in many cases, totally manufactured charges. So this guy's like a professional, like, Nazi hunter. And that's how he would describe himself. He published an op-ed in the Irish Times. It may have been published in other publications as well. But this was just a couple weeks ago. Germans are right to pursue 100-year-old former Nazi war criminals. And he's basically arguing, you know, praising the German government for persecuting these people, and saying that concentration camp staff are the last people on earth who deserve any sympathy. And it's really a very sadistic, you know, like a sadistic op-ed to be published, where it kind of just gives you an insight into the mind of these professional Jewish ethnic activists. And in this case, you know, a professional like Jewish gangster Nazi hunter. Fred, I don't know if you saw this, but I found it incredible. The article is not even worth reading. It's not very long, but basically that's the story. This guy is praising the German government for, you know, prosecuting these elderly people for their alleged role in the Holocaust.
So what are they gonna do? So what happens now? He goes back to Germany, and where does he live? Who pays for him? You know, what goes on now? This is kind of confusing. I mean, you know, you would think the German government would say, please stop sending us these guys.
Yeah, exactly. Well, he highlights, I mean, you had mentioned that the 95-year-old woman who was simply a secretary at one of these concentration camps who was recently charged and is being prosecuted. So he's like citing that as an example, you know, praising the German government for charging these people. It's really incredible. And I think it also serves as, and Jim, I think you mentioned this, it serves as a way to perpetuate this fake narrative and to reinstill it and to continue to, you know, bring it up and reinforce it in society.
Well, you know, there's another problem here, too. And, I mean, the United States had concentration camps before and after World War II. And we had personnel that got to those concentration camps. And under the rules set forth at Nuremberg, and we should also I don't know that they would be extradited because they would be here, but they should also face charges for being participants in concentration camps. And half the people in the U.S. concentration camps didn't belong there. I mean, we were supposed to be putting Japanese in the concentration camps, and we put Chinese in the concentration camps as well. And when somebody said, these people aren't Japanese, well, it doesn't matter. Their eyes are slanted. So, you know, there's a problem. I mean, certain things were set in stone, presumably, at Nuremberg, and what's good for the goose is good for the gander. And the Jews have been chasing presumably high-profile people all over the world, and now when they don't have the high-profile people anymore, there's no Klaus Barbies left or any of these people, they turn around, and now they're picking on the bottom of the totem pole, the little gods. So I don't see any difference in the guy at the concentration camp and the guy at one of our concentration camps.
Yeah, but there is a big difference, Fred. See, the American concentration camps didn't have fake gas chambers.
True.
Well, I mean, that shows they're the same thing. We didn't have any, and they didn't have any.
Well, I'm just saying, if there was any inclination of a gas chamber in the United States camp, then it would have been a different story.
Right. Well, I'll tell you, John, something funny. If this is going on now, I expect that they're going to come for me pretty soon because when this all started and all the publicity was out and people knew who I was, I got a call from a Jewish gentleman in California, and he called me up and he said that Mr. Lucher, he said, I understand. He said, I'm watching what's going on, and he says, you are being persecuted, and I think that's a disgrace because I'm Jewish and we were persecuted in Germany, and now you're being persecuted the same way we were. But that doesn't mean that you're not a despicable person. And I said, well, wait a minute, why am I a despicable person? You just said I was being persecuted. He said, well, you made all those gas chambers. And I said, what gas chambers? He said, you made all the gas chambers at Auschwitz and Birkenau. And I said, what are you talking about? I said, I was 1 year old when all this allegedly was happening. So he says, what do you mean? I said, just what I said. I was a baby. I was born in 1943. He said, oh my God, I'm older than you. I says, okay. He says, I got a white paper from the B'nai B'rith, and it said that you made the gas chambers that were used in Poland. And I said,
wow.
Could you send me a copy of the white paper? No, I'd be afraid to do that. I can't do that. And he hung up. But the bottom line is there's as much pointing to me as having constructed the gas chambers, and I'm just as guilty as this guy they arrested because it's all phony evidence and misinformation. So don't be surprised if they come for me next week.
Yeah, but Fred, the difference with you is you made the Tennessee electric chair, right?
Yes.
Okay, it's got your name on it, right?
That's right.
Okay, they're all waiting for you.
Right, as I said. But I mean, they'd love to get me back in Germany. At least Jews would. But I mean, the bottom line, I should be extraditable if I made the gas chambers, right?
Well, we can arrange that.
I'm sure some Jew will be listening to our conversation here when it gets put online and say, hey there, let's have an extra night, Fred.
Oh. I know your address, Fred. I can give you an address.
Right.
Well, you know what? There's one other article I wanted to bring up, one other topic before we jump into aboutholocaust.org, the main website that I wanted to address in this podcast. Did you guys see any of the headlines, any of the news about the recent Polish court ruling?
Against
the two quote unquote Holocaust Polish Holocaust scholars. There's a woman named Barbara Engelking and then a gentleman named Jan Grabowski, I believe is his name. And they wrote this huge, huge book. It's like 1600 words. And a Polish woman sued these two researchers for basically slandering her uncle. And the Polish court ruled in the plaintiff's favor, this Polish woman, and forced these quote unquote Holocaust scholars to apologize to this woman. And the organized Jewish community, their reaction has been that this is, you know, stifling free speech and stifling Holocaust research. I mean, when I was reading some of this, it's like the chutzpah involved with these people is just through the roof. I mean, they're denouncing this as like an assault on free speech and freedom of like historical inquiry. Meanwhile, they'll throw you in jail for questioning their narrative and, you know, genuinely engaging in free speech and free intellectual historical inquiry. It's astonishing. Jim, yeah, I know. Jim, go ahead. I was going to say,
When I first saw that article, I really didn't get too much into the article about, you know, what it was talking about or this and that. I just looked at the end result and said, are the Jews for this or against it? If they're all upset with it, then we know that it's a good thing.
Yes, and they're very much upset about this because they want to, and see, this shows you, they want to be the only authority on this narrative, on this, especially the fake Holocaust narrative, but really the broader narrative of World War II more generally. They want to be the only people that can explain what happened during this time period. And the Poles have been challenging this sort of stuff for a long time. And, you know, it seems like they're getting sick and tired of getting blamed for being, and, you know, complicit in the alleged Holocaust. And they want to push all the blame onto the Germans, of course. And so this woman, you know, and they seem to have some sympathy even, you know, in their court system, which is kind of astonishing. I mean, I don't think you would have this sort of ruling here in America, at least I wouldn't think anyways. But, yeah, it was interesting. I mean, I thought it was really interesting the way they were so outraged about how, you know, claiming this is an assault on free speech and free, you know, historical inquiry when they're like the primary opponents of genuine freedom of inquiry into this specific topic.
You know, this was something good, though, that happened for the wrong reason. The reason that they sued was not a good reason. The Poles are responding to all the crap that they've been getting and that they shouldn't have been getting. But on the other side of the coin, they should have gone a little further. And they should have, came down on the people who support the alleged Holocaust, because that's where the argument actually goes. I mean, it's good that they took a stand and they said it's illegal for you to make nasty comments about Polish citizens. That's wonderful, but they should have extended that, and they should have extended it. It's illegal for you to make nasty comments about all revisionists, is what they should have done, because they're in the same boat that we are. It's a lie.
Right. And in this specific case, the woman who sued these historians, basically they put in their book that this woman's uncle was complicit in basically like facilitating a whole group of Jews in the village that he was, I think he was the mayor or he was some, you know, like leader of a small Polish village. Yeah. And these two Jewish historians alleged, based on total hearsay, based on, you know, very dubious testimony. I mean, there was really no proof to demonstrate this, and yet they're writing it as if it's fact, that this man was involved in this and complicit in these Jews' murder. And, you know, the woman sued them challenging this, which is, I mean, yeah, that's a good thing. I mean, nobody wants to be slandered, but you're right. I think they could have taken it a step further and really demonstrated that virtually all of this quote unquote Holocaust research by these, you know, Holocaust scholars is fraudulent. I mean, it's based on hearsay. It's based on emotional testimony and exaggerations and outright fabricated testimony in many cases.
Well, I think if you took this a step further, you gotta understand something about Poland. Poland was like 95% Catholic. They hated the Jews. So I think if they investigated this more, they'd probably find out that a lot of the Polish were probably glad to see Jews being killed if they were killed, or they were part of doing it themselves. But that is not part of this conversation. You understand? Okay. Because the deeper they go down this rabbit hole, the deeper they're going to find out that the Polish were probably more involved with killing Jews than they want to admit.
Yeah, but they weren't killing Jews. That's the point.
Fred, I
disagree with you. I disagree. I think these Poles hated the Jews just as much as the Germans weren't happy with them. I think the Poles were not happy with the Jews too. I mean, that's my opinion because they were Catholic. Catholics hated the Jews. I mean, you can't say they liked them. They didn't like them.
No, of course they didn't. But, you know, nevertheless, I still don't think they were murdering Jews.
I beg to differ. I think they probably were, but nobody's reporting it.
Well, so this kind of gets into this website that I wanted to talk about, and I came across this just the other day. It's aboutholocaust.org, and it is administered by the World Jewish Congress and the United Nations Educational, Scientific, and Cultural Organization, which is often just referred to as UNESCO. And apparently the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum, based in Washington, D.C., played a huge role in setting up this website and, you know, having it, you know, serve as like this resource for educating the world. It's an incredibly deceptive and dishonest and really like sort of like childlike the way they present the official, you know, Holocaust narrative. And I guess that's to be expected, right? But it's interesting. I mean, I don't know if you guys had a chance to look at this at all, but I was reading it a couple weeks ago and figured it'd be a good topic to kind of, you know, kind of go through. We don't got to go through the entire website, but certain sections of it would be worth going through. And you know, it's pretty slick. It has a number of different sections that sort of break down and explain, you know, the official Jewish version of the Holocaust. And of course, they, you know, one of their main goals with this website is to quote unquote combat, you know, disinformation and Holocaust denial. And they're always fretting about how, you know, like the younger generation, like doesn't know anything about the Holocaust and, you know, people are sort of tuning out and don't care anymore. So of course, that's like a central aspect of this. Fred, have you had a chance? Did you look at this website at all, or were you familiar with it prior to?
No, I wasn't familiar with it, but I'm not surprised. All the UN ever does, as far as history goes, is perpetuate lies. And that's what they're doing now. I mean, that's not education. That's just plain lies. You know, back when this first started, right after I got back from Poland, and I testified for Zundel, I requested that an international commission be established of engineers, scientists, and historians, and asked that they be sent to Poland to review my findings. That never happened. They never put together an international commission for that purpose. And I raise the issue with UNESCO, from what they're saying now is that the buck stops here with me. I proved that the gas chambers did not exist. They're impossible. There's only one expert on this planet that knows anything about gas chambers, and that's me. Everybody else is dead or retired, and they didn't know anything in the first place. So if they want to keep preaching lies. What they really should do is to find somebody who would be a peer of mine and send that person to me to debate the issue. The problem is they haven't got any peers. There's nobody that's in a position to even talk about the alleged gas chambers or real gas chambers. So the only thing that they can do is either ignore me, which UNESCO does, or what some of the exterminationists prefer to do is they attack my credibility. They attack me as a person. It's ad hominem attacks as usual, but they have no expert that can come up and even talk intelligently with me. So, you know, it seems to me that when these people do this, they should just be totally ignored because they refuse the opportunity to deal with the question as it should be dealt. They refuse to produce a champion. Let them produce a champion. Let's get David and Goliath going here again because they're not going to win. You know, as I've said before, I'm like the Pope. When I speak on matters of gas chambers in the Holocaust, I speak ex cathedra. I am the only one. I don't have any peers, and there's nobody else they can find.
Well, Fred, I do want to mention this. When you gave your report, okay, yes. there's a few things going on here, okay. The Krakow Institute, they went and did an investigation of the so-called gas chambers too,
right.
And the initial report that they gave agreed with basically with your report, okay. So they did send peers in, okay. They did, okay. And their report agreed with your report, but like all good reports, they get buried, and they pretty much just pushed it aside because they didn't like that report.
But that didn't get buried. The Jews jumped on them and they revised it.
Well, that's my point, Fred. That's what I mean. They took the information that was true and they now made it false. So you did have peers, but they lied. Right. Later. But, okay. They went in, they did it, but they lied later. And what are you going to do? I mean, then Luftel, he comes in later. He's an engineer. He gives his report, agrees with you. And then we had Germar Rudolph. He comes in. He gave his report and he agreed with you. So everybody agreed with you. Okay. At one time, anyway.
Right. But what has happened? They ignore us.
That's right.
So yeah, exactly. Well, and it's not only that. Now it's not like any sort of revisionist perspective is systematically ignored and persecuted. I mean, you know, look at all the persecution that you faced. I mean, pretty much any revisionist, especially those in Germany, you know, where you're literally being sent to jail for critically investigating this topic. But you know, now it's not even the mainstream wouldn't even have. I mean, you know, you look back like in the 90s and there were actual debates about the Holocaust. I mean, you think about like the Phil Donahue show where he had at one point he had Mark Weber and David Cole on where they were debating it. Bradley Smith, I think, was also in some debates as well back then. But now you would never see anything like that. And, you know, you go on Facebook and other social media and when, you know, anybody says anything about the Holocaust, this is like the website that shows up. You know, they have like fact checkers and like YouTube. They'll have a link to this website about holocaust.org sending people to get their, you know, official Jewish programming.
They don't do it when I say something, though. They just let what I say go. They're afraid of me.
You mean like if you were to post something on Facebook?
I do all the time. And I have a standing offer with anybody that gets bounced because they posted something. Send the post to me and I'll repost it. They just ignore the fact that I post stuff.
Yeah, but Fred, that's how they deal with you. You have to understand something, Fred, how the Jews work, okay? The first thing they do is ignore you, okay? And that's what they're doing with you. They're just ignoring you. You could put whatever you want up. They're just going to ignore you. Now, if you had a debate with somebody, okay, now when you started getting a debate with somebody else, and now it's getting out there that now you're debating, oh, now they're going to have a problem. See, the Jews, they can't debate. They have to ignore. And that's what they're doing with you. They're just ignoring you.
They still ban a lot of people that aren't debating, that just make comments.
Yeah, I know, but see, they if they know who you are, okay, right, which they probably do.
I'm sure.
They don't want to get this thing going. Whereas Joe Schmo, who puts up a link to some whole, you know, revisionist video or this or that, right, it's easy for them to come against them. They just, you know, delete his account or whatever. But see, if they come against you, then that brings attention to you. You understand?
Right.
They don't even want to bring attention to you. They just want you to go away. And if you don't go away, they're just going to annoy you.
Yeah, but I'm not going to go away.
I know that.
I've repeatedly said on Facebook there were no gas chambers. I've repeatedly said there was no Holocaust.
Okay, Fred, but have you had anybody have a debate with you on the topic? Has anybody responded to you on the topic?
No, because I don't know how to.
No, you're missing my point. That's the point. If you get a conversation up going, then they'll take you right off of Facebook. I'm just telling you how it works. That's how they work. If you get attention to the topic, you know, from other people now, okay, now you're getting other people involved. They'll kick your ass off of Facebook so fast it make your head spin. That's what they do. So, no. I mean, don't feel slighted. I mean, you know, they're just not paying attention to you. They don't want the attention. To you, anyway.
I know they don't. Because they know I'm right. And they know I don't have any peers that can argue with me.
Yep.
Okay, well, hey, you know what? Let's jump into this website. And when you go to aboutholocaust.org, and I'm getting that feedback again. You know what, Jim? I don't know if you have a way to mute yourself when you're not speaking, but I think that is what's doing it. If you could mute yourself when – yeah, okay. So when you go to aboutholocaust.org, the first main section, facts about the Holocaust, all your questions answered – and it says, understanding the past is critical to building a better and safer future for all. The World Jewish Congress, together with UNESCO, established aboutholocaust.org to provide the world with the basic facts about the Holocaust. And they have facts about the Holocaust capitalized. And it, like, the first section is, what was the Holocaust? And this will be a good place to start. And, you know, this is sort of just their basic, you know, explanation of what it is, but let's pick this apart here. It says, the Holocaust was the attempt by Nazi Germany and its collaborators to murder the Jews of Europe during the 6 years of World War II, systematic, bureaucratic, state-sponsored, and government-organized persecution and oppression resulted in the deaths of 6 million European Jews from across the continent. The persecution of Jews in Germany began in 1933, almost immediately after the Nazis came to power. The systematic mass killing of Jews, however, occurred during World War II, first in processes of ghettoization and mass shootings in Central and Eastern Europe, and then between 1941 and 1945, deportations to killing centers like Auschwitz, Treblinka, and Belzec. This phase of systematic killing was referred to by the Nazis as the final solution of the Jewish question. Now, reading this, Fred, I mean, literally almost nothing is right. It's almost like totally the opposite of what they say here.
Yeah.
Go ahead. Why don't you be the first to address this official explanation?
What comes to mind here, right off the bat, is that from 1941 to late 1944 are the times when presumably all these gas executions took place. And unquestionably, they will tell you they all took place using Zyklon B. But if you look at the records, you'll find out that the Germans used very little Zyklon B. First, they didn't have it in stock, and two, they weren't buying it because they didn't have the money to buy it because Germany was bankrupt at that point. If this was the case, what were they using? Well, in 1941, they did have Zyklon B, and they were using it, what they were supposed to be using it for delousing purposes. But as the years went on, they converted mostly to steam, and they also had, most of the logic hams had microwave systems for killing the lice. So very little, if all these gassings took place between, if 6 million people were gassed between 1941 and 1944, how did they do it without Zyklon B, which they weren't using? And the facilities that they were using for steam weren't big enough. You could only get 2 people in a steam chamber. And they were also using DDT, and I've never heard anybody said they sprayed the Jews with DDT. The bottom line is, and they didn't put anybody in a microwave oven. They would have gotten more than killing them. They would have exploded them. So, I mean, you know what happens when you put an egg in a microwave oven. You know what happens? The person's head blows up. And if that was the case, then they would have had a lot of cadavers without heads. But the bottom line is that they don't want to talk about these things. They keep talking about records and say Zyklon B was bought and blah, 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 but it really wasn't. There's no records of this stuff being bought in any quantity because most of the lice were dealt with at that point with DDT and with steam chambers, and then finally with microwave. So, you know, they, in formal logic, that's what's called an undistributed middle. They didn't have the facts to back it up, and it just falls apart. But more so, as far as I'm concerned, anybody who knows anything about executing people with gas knows 2 things. One, it's impractical to use anything that like Zyklon B, which carries the gas. You have to generate the gas in the chamber. The other situation is that it's not possible to do mass executions with the gas, because you can't have a gas chamber that'll take 400 or 500 or even 30 or 40 people. It's just not practical. You don't get gas circulation. I mean, we can't do any more than 2 people, and maybe I could stretch it up to 3, but the problem is that's a large volume of gas to utilize. It takes a lot of people, a lot of gas to kill a small number of people, let alone a large number. So the mechanics of this don't work. The historical background says that they didn't have the chemicals to do it in the first place, but they just ignore all this.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, and they don't understand that the Germans were very avant-garde. They used the best methods that they could. And as I say, by 1944, they were using microwave because it worked more efficiently and it was cheaper and only cost a little electricity to run. They were also using DDT, which was something great. And they never said they threw DDT all over the Jews, but I'll say one thing. We sprayed a lot of DDT on a lot of the Europeans. When we went into Italy, we sprayed it all over the Italian population. When we went into France, we sprayed it all over the French population. I mean, we were spraying that stuff around like there was no tomorrow, and that stuff is poisonous, and it probably killed a lot of civilians. So, you know, but I mean, these things, there were modern ways to kill lice, and the modern ways were steam. The modern ways was microwave and DDT. So,
well, see, that's the thing that I think is critical about understanding is that, you know, we hear all about Zyklon B, and there's a section on this website, why did the German authorities use gas chambers? And they talk about how at the beginning, on the Eastern Front, the Einsatzgruppen, or they call them mobile killing squads, they talk about how they were systematically executing Jews just by, you know, shooting them by firing squad. But then they determined that it was actually more efficient to kill large numbers of people in a short period of time using gas chambers. And they talk specifically about Auschwitz and Majdanek using Zyklon B. But in reality, as you know, you're sort of explaining here, and if, you know, as other revisionists have very well documented at this point, Zyklon B wasn't even used to kill people. It was used to, you know, de-louse clothing and bedding. It was used to provide and ensure a sanitary living environment for these people in the camps. So the whole thing is just totally twisted. The Zyklon B itself wasn't ever meant to be used as, you know, a way to murder people. That's just not at all what was going on. And yet, you know, of course, they state that as fact here on this website. Jim, I wanted to turn it over to you. I mean, you know, you look at that, like, basic definition of what was the Holocaust, and it really needs to be unpacked and sort of systematically explained. For, you know, for example, I mean, was the official, you know, Nazi governmental policy, what was its official policy towards the Jews? I mean, they claim here that it was, you know, their policy was to murder all these people. But was that the case at all? Is there any evidence or proof to demonstrate that?
Here's the thing. I'm going to cover a couple points here. First of all, there was no policy from Hitler to kill the Jews. They try to use the Wannsee Conference saying it was all discussed there. But there's nothing in any document to show that Hitler had any plan from that Wannsee Conference to kill Jews. He wanted to get them out of Europe. That was the plan. Okay. So that puts that to rest. Now, the other point I want to make out, first of all, you have to understand something. Auschwitz wasn't the main camp at this point in time. The Reinhard camps, okay, Treblinka, Sobibor, Belzec, all the Reinhard camps, those were the camps that started out with the so-called execution of the Jews, not Auschwitz. People don't understand this. They think Auschwitz was the main camp. See, in Treblinka, when they started saying that they were executing people in Treblinka, they said it started out they were using diesel gas. Diesel gas. Well, what happened?
And using, how would they even go about doing that?
Well, that's a whole other story. I mean, it was so silly. You have to understand something. The stories come out later, so you have to understand. So they came out and said, I mean, this is all, it was brought out during the Nuremberg trials and all this crap. So they said they were using diesel gas. Well, then they come to find out that diesel gas can't kill anybody. It's got too much oxygen in it. And then they had to revise this story. So then they revised the story and said, oh, it wasn't diesel gas. It was regular gas, because regular gas can put out, you know, a higher level of carbon monoxide, and that can do it. Well, then they found out that was kind of silly, too. And then they said, well, it wasn't regular gas. They were putting the people in chambers and sucking all the air out of the chambers. Now they were suffocating them. You see, what happened was as they brought the stories out and, you know, logical people started to see that these stories didn't make sense, they started changing it and changing it and changing it. So now the Reinhard camps are done with. Okay, let's say 41, 42. By 42, they're done with. Okay, they're gone. They're done with. They claim that, you know, they destroyed the camps, destroyed all the evidence. Okay, so now the Auschwitz camp, comes into play here. So what do they do in the Auschwitz camp? Well, you couldn't say you're going to use diesel gas because they proved that was stupid, and the regular gas was stupid, and sucking air out of rooms was stupid. So now they come up with the Zyklon B gas. You see how it all worked? It was just a progression of nonsense. Everything that got refuted, they just invented something new. So when the Auschwitz camps came online, now they just took something really stupid. Well, we have a bug spray, and we're going to say the bug spray is killing all these people, and people bought it. And so when you really examine the whole thing and just go down the line and how it all progressed, you'll see it was just complete nonsense upon nonsense. And whatever they can get the people to believe, you know, people would end up believing it. So now the story is now that you probably have in Auschwitz, they claim, say, 1 million, 2 million people, you know, at the most, were gassed with Zyklon B. And then you got probably the rest of them were killed, executed, shot with the Einsatzgruppen or whatever you want to say. That's how it is. So it's not 6 million they claim. They don't claim 6 million were killed with Zyklon B. They only claim 1 million or, 2 million at the most, I would think. were supposedly killed with Zyklon B. All the rest were killed by execution and all these other means. So they don't even have, you know, I mean, that's their story now. You understand? The story changes every year. It changes with the tide. Whatever people they can get to bring the stories up now, and, you know, oh, this is a good story, they'll use the story of whatever was the popular story. If they make a movie, well, that will be the popular story, whatever was put in the movie. So, again, the Zyklon B was just complete nonsense because it really had no capabilities of doing anything else except, you know, delousing places and getting rid of lice. But that was about it. But that became the main source now. That people try to, that's what they want you to believe.
Right. Yeah, that's interesting because, I mean, even, you know, this section, why did the German authorities use gas chambers? As I mentioned, they begin by talking about the Einsatzgruppen and how they were, you know, using firing squads to kill large numbers of Jews. And then they determine that gassing is actually more efficient. And it does specifically say that the Operation Reinhard camps use carbon monoxide as developed in the quote-unquote euthanasia program, and that Auschwitz and Majdanek used Zyklon B, you know, to engage in this systematic program of murdering Jews, which is just absurd on the face of it. You know, and they
go ahead. Just a comment I'd like to make on the Reinhard camps. It should be understood, and most people don't understand, that these were transit camps. They were simply railroad sidings and crossroads where they could ship people from various parts of Europe into a central hub where they could then send them to Auschwitz or Birkenau, where they needed them in the Brunner rubber factories to make artificial rubber. So we have, there's nothing at these locations now. And they say, well, everything was torn down. Everything was destroyed. So it's impossible to study this. Well, the bottom line is this. We have aerial photographs that were taken by the Allied Air Forces during World War II. We know what was at the camps. There was only one small barracks and some administration facilities because they didn't even hold, they very rarely held people overnight there. Most of the time they were shipped in and shipped out the same day. There was a bathhouse where they washed. There were steam facilities for destroying the lice on the clothes. The people went in one side and took a bath. They went in and they put the clothes in the other side. They gave them their clothes still damp from the steaming. And they put them on a railroad train and sent them off to Auschwitz someplace. So the bottom line is these facilities were almost nothing. They were a fly speck on the terrain of Europe because they didn't keep people there. They were, as I said, they were railroad hubs and railroad crossings. And all they did was put people on trains going to the various camps where they needed slave laborers. So, you know, people make too much of these things. Now, they said that millions were killed with Zyklon B, and they were buried at the camps. Well, the Jews recently sent archaeologists to these camps, and these archaeologists dug up all these bodies in these mass graves. They said, "Look at all these bodies we found." Well, then some other people went in with ground-penetrating radar, and they examined the locations where these archaeologists said they dug up the alleged bodies. They didn't even dig up the ground. The ground hadn't been disturbed for 50 or 60 years, so there were no bodies. There was nothing found. They just stood there, put a curtain around the ground, and said, "We dug up all these bodies." They're a bunch of liars. So the Reinhard camps, we know what was there. We have photographs of what was there from early and during World War II. So nothing that they said could have happened because there weren't any buildings there to house these things. So I just wanted to mention that because too much is made out of the Reinhard camps that isn't true. And right. We have people like Mark Weber today that believes that the Reinhard camps, they had limited gassings. Right. We have the same thing with David Irving. But I don't know why they changed their position. Somehow, somewhere, somebody put the fear of God into David Irving. And I don't know what happened with Mark Weber. But I do know that we have photographs of these camps. They could not have supported any of the activities that they alleged to them. And there were no limited gassings. It's the same thing as saying somebody is a little bit pregnant. It's either all or nothing.
Right.
So, okay, I just wanted to interject that because they, you know, the Reinhardt camps are gone now, so they can say anything about them.
Well, that's a good point, Fred, because in Auschwitz, okay, especially Birkenau, you had 300 or more barracks because people ended up in Birkenau because that's where they stayed. Whereas the Reinhardt camps had no barracks. You won't find any barracks there. I mean, but think about it. Compared to Reinhardt camps with Treblinka that had 300 or more barracks, showing you that the activity in Auschwitz were people staying there, working there, and people don't get it. If you want to make a big thing about, all the people, 400 Hungarians at the end of the war came into Auschwitz, and they were all gassed in 8 weeks. 400,000, they claim, in 8 weeks. And it's like, really? Those 400,000 Hungarians they claim that came in, they were just distributed to other camps. And that's what ended up happening to them. They weren't executed in gas chambers. But again, they have a story to tell, and that's the story they tell.
Wow. Interesting. I'm trying to see. I found it earlier. Yeah, here it is. What is the difference between a concentration camp and an extermination camp? And I think, you know, you guys have kind of, you know, explained this, you know, in just your previous comments. But I think this is so critical to understand is because most people, you know, most people, frankly, don't know much at all about the alleged Holocaust. They just know Hitler and the Germans and the Nazis are evil and they hated the Jews for no reason and they wanted to kill them all and they did kill them all. Using gas chambers and murder and whatnot, but I mean, really, what was going on with this network of concentration camps throughout pretty much all of Europe during World War II, or at least all of the parts of Europe that Germany controlled? What was, and Fred, maybe you can start out by addressing this. What was the point of these camps? And you said there's different categories, right? You know, you have the Reinhardt camps that were more transit facilities versus Auschwitz, which was more of a, I look at Auschwitz as more of like a factory town, like a community. Industrial facility.
That's what it was. Germany really had no concentration camps. Germany had slave labor camps like Auschwitz, Birkenau, and Majdanek. They had transit camps. But the transit camps really didn't do anything. The people weren't there. They had a minimal amount of staff, and all they did was ship people through. We had concentration camps in the United States. And I don't know any place where there was an extermination camp. There's no such thing. So, I mean, we can actually toss that right in a wastebasket because it didn't exist. The Germans couldn't afford to exterminate the Jews or any of the people they put into the concentration camps because they needed the slave labor. They had no money. The country was bankrupt. They had no people to put in factories because they were killing them fighting a war. So, I mean, the bottom line is you gotta parcel out and do what you can with what you got. We got a bunch of people that are useless. We can use them for slaves, and they sent them to the concentration camps at Auschwitz and Birkenau and Majdanek, where they actually were contributing to the war effort. Meanwhile, the German citizens were fighting in the military, and the transit camps were only to get everybody to these slave labor camps. But that's a misnomer. There were no concentration camps in the sense that a real concentration camp. We had them here. We had Chinese and we had Japanese in these camps, but they didn't have to work. They were given little stuff to keep them busy, but we weren't using them making military hardware and we weren't using them as slaves. The difference was Germany was, and it had to because it had no choice. It could not have supported the war. Remember, Germany is a country the size of Texas, and they were fighting the entire world.
Right, exactly. When you refer to like a concentration camp, you mean like basically like a detention facility where you're essentially a prisoner. You're not being put to work. You're not doing anything productive. You're basically just detained. Versus the camps in Germany, I mean, you had like the transit camps, which were, you know, just designed to, you know, facilitate the movement of people. Yeah. But the actual, forced labor camps, you refer to it as slave labor, I guess. Yeah. And Jim, maybe you can address this. I mean, what were, you know, again, it's presented as this, you know, monstrous, horrific experience. What were these, you know, slave labor camps actually like? I mean, how were these people treated?
I kind of have a different view here, all right? See, the Germans were capturing a lot of communists, you know, the communists. So what are you going to do with them? Okay? They were soldiers. And they had to be, and then you had then you had bad people, okay? So you had to put them in camps where bad people go, okay? Because these people were definitely not good for the cause. And so they were in camps that would be, I'd consider like jail.
Yeah.
You understand? There's a big difference. In other words, they were in camps that would be considered prisons. And I believe most of those camps were in Germany. Okay, so in other words, you'd ship them into the German Reich, and then you'd put them in camps that these people would be kind of in prison because they're communist soldiers, and they're
POWs.
Yes, POWs. So if you have to look at it like that, so there's a difference between what was done in Germany and what was done in Poland. Okay, with the other camps. The other camps were more of the type of work camps. Okay, with the general population people. Okay, and then in Germany, as far as I understand this now, I mean, you could correct me if I'm wrong. I think that the majority of camps in Germany, where you would need military personnel watching these guys, they were more like concentration prison camps. Okay. So there's like a little bit of a difference here in distinguishing the camps. I mean, I'd have to look into it a little bit more, but that's as I understood it. Yeah, there were concentration hard labor camps where prisoners who were captured or dissidents were put in, and they had hard labor or whatever they were used for in those camps. That's what they were used for. And whereas Auschwitz had pretty much, you know, general type of Jews, general type of people that were working. And it was a more freer type of camp, you know what I'm saying, in regards to moving around and getting around, you know, like that. That's, you know, my opinion. Correct me if I'm wrong, but that's, you know, that's my opinion on it.
Well, I got to ask, I mean, what were the conditions of these various camps like? I mean, were people being mistreated? Were people being raped and murdered? And stuff like that, or I mean, what was going on? Because that's, again, that's the Jewish narrative, right? That, you know, these were
like
oppressive, horrific camps.
You have to distinguish the camps. Auschwitz had a general population of men and women, okay? And honestly, most of the people in Birkenau, most of them didn't work, okay? That's why there were so many barracks, because a lot of them were old, and then there was children. Now, when you get into Buchenwald, and you get in the Dachau, what are you going to notice there if you look at the pictures? You see any women in those pictures? No. They're all men. Okay? Because these were guys that were put in concentration camps. All right? Because they had to be, segregated away from the rest of people. And that's what happened there. Again, I believe, you know, like I said, these camps you can do your own research on. But in Germany, These were concentration camps, more so than Auschwitz, the camps in Auschwitz and Majdanek and the Polish camps.
But the people in Dachau were too. That was one of the prime producers of German military uniforms.
So, right, but I'm just saying, I didn't see a lot of women in those camps.
Oh, well, yeah, I don't know what the, sexual count was.
They had, again, a lot of these camps were used to do the new military work, okay? And I believe it was Buchenwald. Dora was a sub-camp of Buchenwald, and that's where they made the V-2 missile. And that's where they put a lot of the men. The men had to work underground, working on the V-2 missile, And one of the problems that happened in those camps, because these guys were prisoners. Now, you're talking POW prisoners. And what they were doing is sabotaging. They were sabotaging the V-2 missiles. And what happened is, if they were caught doing that, they were immediately executed. And so, again, you know, the Germans had a way of doing all this, and they used the prisoners, hard labor prisoners, to do hard labor work. Okay. Whereas the other camps, like I said, was a little more lighthearted. You know, Auschwitz, you know, had a place in it called Canada where they took in, supplies, they took in clothing. It was like the big Salvation Army. All right. And that's where a lot of the women work, you know, and things like that.
Right. Okay. Well, I mean, is it safe to say that none of these camps were set up or designed to systematically murder anybody? I mean, because again, that's sort of the way this is presented. This idea of an extermination camp where people were sent to just simply to be murdered in whatever way it was, whether it was using Zyklon B or being shot or whatever, or starved. I mean, was that the case? Were any of these camps set up for that purpose? That, you know, is such a central part of the story?
Heaven forbid one of the commandants at Auschwitz was removed from command because he had too many people die of typhus. They needed those people to work in the factories. They couldn't afford them to die for any reason. They were given the best medical treatment. They had recreation at Auschwitz. They had the inmates had a symphony orchestra. They had a swimming pool. They had all kinds of stuff to recreate so they would work better. So no, they weren't being tortured any place. They weren't being punished any place. I mean, hard work. Somebody might say, well, hard work is torture, but like everything else, I mean, and as he said, as Jim said, they had people working underground. Yeah, von Braun had a lot of people up at Peenemünde, and they had underground factories where they were assembling the V-1 and the V-2 rockets. But I mean, yeah, that's probably hard work, and they dug and built these factories. But like everything else, they utilized all of the work capability of the people they had. They had no choice.
Yeah, there was no execution camps, but I would imagine that if someone did something wrong in any of these camps, that they could be killed. I mean, if they were trying to sabotage or blow up something or hurt somebody in the camp, rape somebody in the camp, well, whatever, it doesn't matter. I'm sure they would have been taken care of.
They were, and at Auschwitz, the Jews had their own court system. If a Jew killed another Jew or injured another Jew, he was tried and he was turned over to the camp authorities for punishment. And a good number of Jews were executed for murder by the camp authorities on sentencing from the tribunal that found them guilty. So the people were killed, but I mean, these were people who were tried. Were tried by their own people and killed for murder. And yeah, I I'm sure, as you said, if you sabotage something, you were going to get shot because that was considered to be treason.
The German soldiers were very well mannered for the most part. I can't speak for them all because you're going to have wackos in any group of people, Germans or Americans. But the Germans, if they were told, they knew, they had a code of ethics. Okay, I think it was like 25 things they had to abide by. One of the things that they couldn't do, they couldn't abuse prisoners. If they were caught abusing a prisoner or hurting a prisoner and definitely killing a prisoner, they would be put on trial. And they did. I heard that as many as 200 Germans were shot and hung or whatever for abusing prisoners. I mean, that figure can be checked. But the point is they did execute some German soldiers for the abusing the people in some of these camps. They were not to do that at all, and people don't understand that.
Right.
They were probably. Yeah, no,
go ahead, Fred.
I was just going to say they were probably better men than some of our soldiers, because I had a friend who was with the occupation people in Germany, and they had he was working at a camp where they had a number of women prisoners inside this fence. And one of these women was rather hardcore. She was a Hitler youth, and there was always taunting going back between the U.S. guards and the prisoners. And this woman flipped up her dress. She pulled down her pants, and she exposed herself, and she made an obscene gesture toward her vagina. One of the guards in the camp shot her in the vagina, and she wound up going to the hospital. I don't know if she ever died, but that American soldier that shot her was sent to some kind of an education class explaining that you don't shoot prisoners. But, I mean, the bottom line, I don't know that the Germans did any of that, but, I mean, I'm sure we did some of it. And, you know, when you get,
right.
you know, that shouldn't happen. And by and large, as Jim said, the Germans were well-mannered.
Yeah, and, you know, I read a book. Dr. Nicholas Kahlerstrom wrote a book a few years ago called Breaking the Spell. And it's, in my view, one of the best revisionist books that I've read anyways. And in that book, he makes it pretty clear that the German authorities administering these camps were not only very well-behaved and really did care for the people that they were, you know, guarding and looking over, but they were, you know, as you guys are mentioning, they were actually punished if they mistreated any prisoners or did anything to break the rules, to break the code of honor and ethics that they had in place. And not only that, rather than being, you know, extermination centers, the German authorities were doing everything in their power to ensure that these camps were well administered, they were sanitary. I mean, it's literally like the exact opposite of the official narrative. And it's, you know, again, it's pretty well documented and proven at this point. It's just this revisionist perspective never gets the light of day. And it's always presented, you know, from this, it's really like a Jewish horror story, like this whole Holocaust narrative. And there's very little evidence and proof to demonstrate that their narrative is correct at all.
Right. Can I bring out a point, John?
Yeah. Yeah, go ahead.
You might find this interesting, because Fred touched on it a little bit. Haas, he was in Auschwitz, and I believe he was there in the early stages of Auschwitz. 42 or thereabouts. But they got rid of him, eventually, and he eventually was put on trial and killed and hung, you know, or whatever. But the last command.
If you could call it that.
Yeah, yeah. The last commandant of Auschwitz, his name was Richard Bayer. Now think about this. This is a very interesting story. Richard Bayer, he was the last guy, last commandant in Auschwitz. And the war ends, and now, you know, they're obviously going after all the Nazis. You know, they're putting them on trial and this and that. Now, Richard Bayer, his story was this. They asked Richard Bayer, what was going on in Auschwitz? Were there any gas chambers? Were anything bad going on there? And he, you know, his official story, no, everything was fine in this camp. It was run fine. There was no executions. People weren't being gassed. I never saw a gas chamber. Okay, that's great. So this is at the end of the war, right? You know, that's his story. So what later on, what happens is because, you know, the trials, you know, Nuremberg trials and the IMT trials, and there were trials coming out of your ass here. There were so many trials, you couldn't believe it, because every group of people, the English, the French, the Americans, the Russians, let's say you went to trial, the Nuremberg trial, okay, and you were found innocent in the Nuremberg trial. Okay, that was primarily, you know, like an American type of trial. Okay, so now you'd go, the Russians would bring you on trial, and they want to get you now. And then, oh, you were found innocent in that trial. Well, then the French would want to get you in that trial. And then it just kept going down the line. Okay, so there were many, many, many trials. Okay, so let's move up a few years here. We're going to come up to 1960, I think it was 62, 63, around there, maybe 64. So Richard Bayer now, okay, because now he's a survivor. He was in the camp. They want to put him on trial, all right? And Richard Bayer was they found him. You know, they found him, put him in jail, and now they're going to put him on trial, you know, a few years later here. And Richard Bayer's story, remember, nothing happened at Auschwitz. Everything was great at Auschwitz.
Richard Baer was a hulk of a man. He was a tree worker. He probably had the best health of anybody you'd ever know. And just think about this, okay? Right before the trial, Richard Baer mysteriously dies. Mysteriously dies. Because he was one of the only living commandants in the camps that was alive to tell the truth. And they couldn't have him testify. And you bet your sweet ass they probably killed him. All right? And so just do some research on Richard Baer, because it's an interesting story, because of the fact that this guy would have blown the whole freaking thing wide open, but yet they had to kill him. I mean, my opinion, they had to kill this guy. Sad story.
Yeah, very interesting. There was a lot of people that were killed in the aftermath of the war that were tortured, mistreated, executed. It was really a vicious and gruesome period of time.
Yeah, well, what do you think the whole Nuremberg trial was? I mean, think about the Nuremberg trials, okay? You have 20, I think it was around 20, 22 people put on trial, and it's a real military trial here. And that, you know, 11 of them were found guilty and they were executed. But what type of trial do you see a person, he's found guilty and within a week or whatever, they're executed? I mean, usually if you go to trial and you're found guilty and you do get an execution sentence, you get to appeal. You get to appeal your case. There was no appeal here. They had to get rid of these guys. They had to get rid of, because if they were ever alive to testify later, it would have just blown the whole thing open of what happened in these camps. Remember, these guys didn't know anything, most of them. There was nothing going on in these camps that they knew about. But if they were alive to testify or write a book about, my God, it would have just exposed the whole Holocaust, the whole thing as a big scam. And they couldn't allow these guys to live. So they had to execute 11 of them. And then, of course, the other ones, you know, got some pretty good, you know, sentences and they were released or whatever later. But, you know, you could see how the whole narrative here was controlled right from the beginning, from the story of the fake gas chambers. We have to blame it all on the Germans because, really, the Allies were the guilty party. The Allies were the ones guilty of genocide. They were the ones that should have been put on trial, but they had to take all the guilt trip off of them, and they had to put the whole guilt trip on the Germans, and then they had to get this fake gas chamber story going, you know, that so everybody can feel sorry for the Jews and feel like, oh no, the Jews are all killed here. And then they get the Nuremberg trials going to get rid of the evidence. They had a perfect system here and how to do all of this, and people just don't get it. Follow it all through. But no, they're never going to do that. They're just going to look at, oh, the poor Jews, they were put in gas chambers and they were killed. It's all about the Jews.
But you have to remember, too, that these trials were probably, if they were looked at, they were probably all illegal. They were all in violation of the Geneva Convention. You're not supposed to try former military personnel, and that's what they did.
Right. And Fred, not only that, but some of the guys tried in those trials, I don't know really all the names, but some of them weren't even military. They were just common citizens, and they were being tried in a military trial. You don't put common citizens in a trial, a military trial, and accuse them of acts of genocide, things of that sort.
You also have to remember that there was no evidence ever presented.
Right.
The trial took judicial notice of the alleged gas chambers. They took judicial notice of all of the alleged illegal activities, but there was no evidence presented that any of these people ever did any of these things.
Right.
And there was also, they weren't allowed to present evidence that they didn't. So, you know, a lot of our military personnel were not happy with what was going on at Nuremberg and at some of the other locations. But these military officers that came there were all new officers. Most of them were lawyers and most of them were Jews, and they were sent over there to execute all these Germans. And
yeah, that was the plan. I mean, the plan was get rid of the evidence, get rid of anybody that could talk later. And also, too, about these trials, what a lot of people don't know this either, that they had paid informants, okay, people that were paid to go to these trials and lie, and they went from trial to trial to trial, lying their asses off about things that happen in these camps, and then you couldn't even refute them. You couldn't even present a case to say, no, that wasn't true. They didn't listen to you. All the affidavits, all were lies, all were fake. I mean, what a system they had. It was just beautiful and how they did this.
Well, as I said, a lot of our military people did not like it because they said, if in the next war we lose, they'll do the same thing to us.
That's right.
I mean, they set a precedent there at Nuremberg, and it was a very dangerous precedent to set. And the people that set the precedent were politicians and lawyers that just put on military uniforms to make it look like they were military. None of the people involved in the trials were actually participants in the war. They all came over afterward. And right. These are the same people that we got in the Department of Justice today that are deporting all these privates and soldiers that did all what was going on at the camps in the first place. So
right.
these people should be ashamed of themselves.
Yeah.
You know, there's one last section I want to bring up here before we wrap up the podcast, and that is the section dealing with the quote unquote final solution. And this is something that, you know, even like, you know, average people, they'd probably recognize, you know, the final solution to the Jewish question or whatever. And, you know, they describe it, of course, as the term used by German authorities that referred to the plan to, quote unquote, annihilate European Jewry. And, in this section, they specifically mention a memorandum from Hermann Göring to Reinhard Heydrich, dated July 31st, 1941, asking where Göring asked Heydrich to prepare an overall plan of the preliminary organizational, practical, and financial measures for the execution of the intended final solution of the Jewish question. And they later referred to the Wannsee meeting, which is another, you know, sort of notorious meeting that's, you know, of course, central to the official Holocaust story. And they say that this was when the German government came together and actually implemented, you know, laid out and implemented this plan to, quote unquote, annihilate the Jewish people and, you know, enact this final solution of the Jewish question, which in their, you know, their narrative, their interpretation was the systematic mass murder of Jews. Jim, what was the actual final solution to the Jewish question that the Germans, you know, sort of formulated? I mean, what was their overall policy towards the Jews? Certainly wasn't to murder all of these people.
No, like I mentioned in the beginning, the Wannsee Conference was just to get the Jews out of Germany, out of Europe. That was the plan. The thing is, when the war started, you know, they had a plan of getting them to Madagascar. And eventually even getting them to, well, some of them actually did go to Palestine, but that was the plan. I mean, they, it wasn't extermination. It was just getting them out of there. Okay. Emigration, I guess it's called, you know, getting a group of people out of the country because the Jews basically were a communist group of people for the most part. Okay. They were a fifth column group of people that you didn't really want in your country because they were just doing a lot of bad stuff. And they were undermining the government of Germany anyway. So that was it. I mean, Hitler, you know, he just wanted them out. And what happened with Reinhard, I mean, that's his name there. He, you know, they actually ended up killing him. They executed him.
He was assassinated, wasn't he, by, like, communist terrorists in Prague, I think.
He probably could have been Hitler's protege. Taking his place later. So they definitely wanted to get rid of him. So they killed him. But yeah, the Wannsee Conference is a big joke because, I mean, for the Jews, it's a joke because there's no evidence to show that they were trying to, make a policy to eliminate the Jews. And any documentation you're going to get on that is probably fake. Okay. So you gotta deal with all that stuff that comes in later, because they're gonna present a lot of fake documents, and say, oh, well, this was said, that was said, and it's gonna look official. It's gonna be on German typewriter paper and have the official emblem and, you know, all of this, the imprimatur, all the things on the paper that look official. But a lot of that stuff is all just fake and false information.
Right. So it was really a policy to essentially ethnically cleanse Germany and other, you know, German-administered territories of Jews, essentially, was to deport them and to, you know, strip them of their citizenship. Well, and I mean, they recognize him. They openly said this and had policies to this effect, yeah, openly recognizing the Jews as, an, you know, like a hostile, alien, foreign group of people that was working to undermine and subvert their society. And, of course, anybody that's looked at the Jewish question would clearly recognize that is indeed the case. We see that on display in America times 10 today. Yeah. So, you know, a very, in my view, a very, you know, rational policy to implement. Maybe not the nicest or most pleasant, you know, policy, but certainly a rational policy to implement considering the circumstances.
Yeah. But John, not all Jews were dealt that way. There was, you gotta understand, people don't know this either. There were Jews that were still in Germany that weren't in the camps. Not all Jews went to the camps. If there were Jews, like, you know, we already know there was 150,000 Germans who were part Jew or half Jew or whatever. They served in the armies and navies and of the German Reich. So there were Jews still in Germany, a small amount of them probably. You know, I don't know, maybe 100,000, who the hell knows? But I mean, cause Joe, I mean, Diane interviewed, Germans who were there at the time, they're older women now, that said in the towns they lived in, and I have this on, we have this on tape, the towns they lived in, Jews were still in their towns. They weren't in jail. They weren't in the camps. And temples were still open. They make it look like all the temples were closed. The Jews, you know, still were functioning in some areas that weren't the communists, that weren't the ones who were trying to overthrow Germany. Again, you got to find some good Jews amongst them. And, you know, they were still functioning, no problem at all.
Right. So the policies were primarily directed at the subversive communist elements, you know, comprising, you know, Jewry, which wasn't everybody, as you mentioned. Yeah, and that's interesting. There is a book, I think it's, I can't remember the guy's name who wrote it. I think it's called Hitler's Jewish Army or something like that. And yeah, it documents that there were, you know, hundreds of thousands of, at least partially Jewish soldiers in the German army. So it's much more nuanced, I guess, than even the way I just explained it. So,
you know, It should be noted too that that the German government instituted the Final Solution before the war. They had, I believe, three steamships loaded with Jews that they sent off that they didn't want. They were deporting them, or they were allowing them to emigrate. And they stopped at a half a dozen countries, including the United States, including France, and some in South America, and they were all refused. They were not allowed entry. That was the Final Solution. Send them off and let them go to some other country. But the other countries didn't want them, because traditionally, wherever the Jews were, there was a Final Solution. And the Final Solution was, we're throwing you out of the country. I mean, even when they were slaves, back in the, when they lost the war to Babylon, and Babylon took all of them to Babylon as slaves, they eventually kicked them out of Babylon and said, you're not worth it. You may be slaves, but what we get out of you, you're not worth the trouble you cause. Titus, Emperor Titus, he turned around and he kicked them all. He started the diaspora. He kicked them all out and he destroyed the temple, because no matter where they were, they caused trouble. And, you know, the one of the best places you could ever be is the Roman Empire, because all they cared was that you paid your taxes, you fought in the army if you were needed, and didn't start trouble. Well, the Jews couldn't even exist there. They were kicked out of there. So every place they went, they tried to get rid of them. And they usually did. They chased them out. They, as I said, Hitler put them on boats, but nobody would take them. They come back and they wound up coming back to Germany. So,
right. And there was even that famous case where Jews are still lecturing, you know, the American government about this, how a boatload of quote unquote Jewish refugees was turned away from America. Even, I don't know, I can't remember the exact year. But it's something that the Jews are still very much upset about and still, you know, lecture us about how Americans were even, you know, complicit in the Holocaust and complicit in Jewish persecution and stuff. So, it's incredible.
We were complicit in not accepting them, so we were complicit in the final solution. But the final solution was deportation. That shows it.
Right, yeah, it certainly wasn't mass murder, yeah.
That's what they talked about at Wannsee, the port to Madagascar. Unfortunately, I don't think the Germans had asked anybody in Madagascar whether they wanted them, because they probably would have been refused there, too.
Right.
So, yes.
All right, fellas, well, this has been a great conversation. I knew it would be. It's a huge topic, but I thought it was I thought it'd be a good idea to kind of sit down and look at that website, because it is an incredibly dishonest and deceptive website, but this is typical. This is what you get from the Holocaust industry, and it certainly is an industry. And you know, this fake narrative is constantly perpetuated and reinforced, not only by, you know, the government, but also by mainstream society, Hollywood, the media, our educational establishment. You know, it basically pervades all aspects of life. And it is one of the most pervasive lies in our society, and it needs to be combated and debunked and openly discussed. So that was kind of the goal with this program, and I think we did a good job of doing just that.
Yeah, good job, John. Yes. Enjoyed talking to you.
Very much.
All right, guys. Yeah, thank you very much. We'll have to do this again, and you guys enjoy the rest of your weekend.
Okay, John. Take care now.
Good night, John.
All right. Bye, guys.